William started off really talking pretty much, you know, objectively and practically about what's happening in public health, in interviewing medical care and public health. And a lot of it, actually some of the aspirational things that they tried to put in place. I'm taking it even further. As my role as a state health official and as a hospital president, I have a holy pulpit in both of those locations like I've never had before. And so what the holy pulpit allows me to do is really talk about why I'm in this in the first place and sort of try to get people to think beyond what they're normally talking about and what they're usually working at, and try to get people out of the swim lanes that they have put in by themselves or by their organization. And so I'm going to use that holy pulpit and really talk a little bit about sort of the aspirations I have for public health and where we need to go and what we need to do that leads up to this triple A health equity. Now, all Michael District Task Manager, she told us to talk about motivation, momentum, barriers, challenges, opportunities, and optimism. And certainly the barriers, or the motivation and things that the momentum, the motivation really come from the data. You know, we have life expectancy in this country that you heard this last week is flat over, not improving in life expectancy. And starting back in the late 70s, our life expectancy improvements have started to slow compared to other industrialized countries. And so we have been falling farther and farther behind in terms of life expectancy compared to other places. Certainly infant mortality, the type of work we got for all my professional career, has gone from we were in the top 10 back in the 60s and now down into the 30s. We should have been consistently going down. And if we look at health equity, and look at disparities, particularly where we had infant mortality, we saw the infant mortality rate, the disparities in infant mortality between whites and people of color and everything increased dramatically starting in the late 70s and early 80s, and it continued to rise. So we have some of the greatest disparities in the country. And so it's also interesting that when our disparities started to rise, and when our longevity started to slow, rates of improvement in longevity, that's when our healthcare costs started to increase. Because we went after those issues by investing in a medical model towards what we wanted to do. So come back to that a little bit, but for me, when I started in the Department of Child Health at the City Health Department in 1980, focused on mortality and disparities. When I came back into governmental public health as state health official, state health officer in Minnesota in 2011, I looked at infant mortality and recognized that the infant mortality rate in African Americans in my state and in the country in 2011 still had not reached the infant mortality rate for whites in 1980. In that period of time, all of our efforts, with all the investments that we made in money and in health care, in medical approaches, we still have not really made much progress. So that brought me back to the definition of public health from Jeffrey Baker, that I use quite frequently, because this is why he says the landmarks of political, economic, and social history are the moments when some condition passes from the category of the given into the category of the impossible. I believe the history of public health has been well written as a record of successive redefining something unacceptable. Just think about that it's a given that African American and American Indians are going to die twice the rate. That's a given. Why is that a given? Why is not that intolerable? We have incarceration rates on African American males at 10 times that price. In some cities, half of the African American males are either in prison or on a felony. Why? And that's just a given. Why? It's intolerable. And it's a given that we look at our healthcare system. Why is that? That should be how we should look influenced by socioeconomic circumstances. We have this narrative in our country that says, this is a common narrative, that if people have access to good medical care and make good personal choices about physical activity and nutrition, we would be healthy. That's the narrative. So that's where all our energy goes. And that's where we focus our investments. And so one of the ways we've done that is by putting the triple aim of healthcare, which I think is a good thing. I'm not going to, slam healthcare, because we need healthcare. And the triple aim, access, quality, and cost, and population focus, which is sort of population medicine, population health. But it focuses on, that one of the barriers is that it focuses on individuals sort of independent of their community. It's like you have to be healthy without your community, and actually you can't. Looking at, Wendell Berry says, looking at the smallest measure of health really should be the community. Because separating an individual independent of the community is an oxymoron, it just doesn't work. So that's why I think barriers are putting this narrative that medical care, health care, is going to improve health. And that personal choices, people who just make personal choices, we can all help them. Yes, but people make choices in the context of their community. They make choices in the context of their environment. We talk about them taking healthy choices and easy choices. But we're trying to make healthy choices but possible choices. Because many places, people don't have a choice in health. So, the opportunities are for my position now as Health Commissioner of the State of Minnesota and National President. I think we have to reframe our conversation. Support the triple aim of health care. I think we need a triple aim of health equity, which is on the screen here, which really is a change in the way you practice. These are a set of practices that change how we in public health have to have the function. And these practices are one, give them, strengthen or expand, first of all, expand our understanding of what creates health. We need to change the narrative. I think that's probably the most important thing that we can do. That's why I'm focusing most on this rather than some of the specifics. We have to change the narrative, because unless we change the narrative, our investments and our efforts won't change. So we have to expand our understanding that it's the socioeconomic circumstances in which people live. And it's the policies and systems that have been put in place by political action, by policy action, that really are making the greatest difference. It's not surprising. I mean, took a policy direction difference in the 70s and 80s, our health system hasn't changed. Those are policy decisions that are impacting our health. And so we really need to, first of all, expand our understanding of what creates health. It also generates more partners in the conversation. Certainly, when we did that in our state, we talked about minimum wage being a public health issue. We brought a whole lot of folks around the table talking about from a public health perspective, about economic factors. We were able to pass them in a way which I think is the greatest public health achievement in our state in the 9/11 health care. Secondly, we have to implement health law policies. Implement health law policies for health equity as a goal. So if we change the conversation for so we get more partners, and so you want transportation and education and human services and corrections, all looking at what we're doing with a health equity lens. But you also have to make sure that it is a lens that includes health equity. Not just a health lens, but a health equity lens. Because if you don't have health equity and health law policies, you can either be gentrification and transportation projects and housing projects, or like minimum wage, or pay leave, we're working on pay leave. If only people at the top of the income strata and our full-time workers in large institutions get paid leave, and the low-income workers and part-time workers don't get paid leave, we're just actually enhancing disparities. So you have to help them follow this approach with health equity as a goal. And finally, we have to strengthen the capacity of communities to create their own contribution. This is the community organizing piece. When communities come together, they have a lot more power than I can have as a health officer. Tell communities that they have more influence to my other than I do. They are organized to do that. We've seen examples of that, passing the minimum wage, getting to stops. We have an example of a Central Florida light rail trying to move people from one of the Twin Cities to the other. The metric initially was as fast as you can move people from one side to the other. That was the metric. People in the middle, people of color, low income, that were being excluded in these times. So they organized to actually change federal staff added to this. So we see that communities are engaged to really make a huge difference. So we actually engage communities to ask them, to have them ask our legislature, have us as a health department do a white paper on income and health. They ask our legislature to ask us to do a white paper on AD and health. We're asking there, we're getting the community to ask the legislature to ask us to do what we already want to do. This is where they have power. The legislators, the policymakers have to listen to this. So my optimism is that people are ready, right? We talk about discrimination for health equity. People are saying, yes, this is the stuff that we've been waiting for a long time. It changes how we do our practice. It's really focused on the social justice mission. But what that actually can change the conversation about what we do, creating new partners to give us a way to empower communities. We've seen that happen over and over and over again. And I think with you taking on this program of health equity, we're going to be able to do that again. Thank you.
Structural systems change happening in Oregon. We've heard about a children's hospital system, more broadly defined, mission-driven, incorporating public health practice and policy in this work. And we've heard about a pitch to you about how we can organize and give this framework about a mutual parade for health equity as a and convening conversation in the work between public health and clinical medicine. I'm going to pick it apart a little bit. So I'm going to challenge them. And then I'm going to put you on the next 10 minutes just to challenge yourself and see the conversation. Ready for that? Let me understand this notion about governance. And it's not only Logan, because it goes to the question about who decides. Who decides to decide? There's a lot of decisions being made here about the ultimate distribution of power. And in a large, transforming health system. So from philosophy to bottom line, how did you decide who would decide and how it would be decided? How is government set forth? And how, what do you do with those tensions? And I'm going to start with the Rodenberg, because you're trying to come into a system and convince them that in fact that their bottom line is going to go for something different. How does decision-making work in your system in this population health
stuff? Thanks, Amanda. And I'm going to share with my colleagues who I know will have something to add from their perspectives. Right, I'll comment on two different things. One, who decides about our systems? And we have a letter from having a really enlightened and engaged leadership team, a board and CEO, that understands and values science. They are learning the science of public health. They are learning the science of public health. And what I mean by that is, when I was brought to the system to help achieve a vision, and I said, that's really audacious. Do you know what that means? They very honestly said, no, not really. Because if we know it means we're going to need to do something differently, but we don't know what that is, which is why we're here. And so their commitment, within 5 years, and reaffirms that as a latest retreat, it is their commitment to realizing a vision of having the healthiest, not fully sick, but the most well, fully well, children and families in the state. I think that is a luxury. You can find my colleagues in other health systems who have a slightly different why. And this is a little bit of what I was alluding to before, that health systems are financially, particularly adults, health systems are financially incentivized now, right, to keep people out. That's how they behave, is keeping people out of healthcare delivery system. And so there are a variety of different strategies to achieve that. That is not necessarily population health, that's not population health, that's vision management. It is still important, but it's not the same thing. And I do want to make sure to acknowledge that. So the question of governance at the local level, we're going to share a little bit about our partnership with communities, which is a capacity building partnership. And that means the power is with the community. medical hierarchy. They are job, safety, I need food, and I need, you know, safe housing. None of which we do as a healthcare delivery system, right? Not for time, but we support their skill development in being able to achieve those goals, whether it is understanding how policy happens and how they can be active and engaged in policy development, because we know this works for the health of that community. The hardest thing thus far in our journey has been ensuring that our partners let the residents lead. And that those partners include sometimes other healthcare delivery systems or community service agencies who are all accustomed to being in charge, having power, right? And so they're accustomed to coming in, making the diagnosis, this community has this, that, this, it is my role to fill this gap because that is how I am paid. And it is our challenge to remind all of our collaborators the resident lead we follow, we support.
So then I'm going to just pick on you a little bit here, because I'm curious, if you've been trying to negotiate at state level, not so much at community level, who will be in charge of what are the accountabilities, how are decisions made, how is that playing out in the transformation arc?
Well, thanks, it's a journey. You know, I can remember when I was many, like, a couple years ago, people said, that hit at $1.9 billion, you know. And our governors said, we start 5 years ago, and you convene people from different sectors to say, what is it that, to Ed's point, what is it that we want here as a community? What do we want to look like in the end? And very often, what you were in charge of is not what people were concerned about. So you have to build that consensus. I think that for us, doing things like letting go of some old ideas about even how state, governmental, public health should be organized, and giving up a little power and being within a secretariat with Medicaid, with a number of other policies and data measurements. So that we can influence how they look at things. I mean, I do think that the secret sauce is probably positive that there's analogy in our data, but we sometimes just lay it out there and we don't analyze it, and we don't look at what we're talking about is what is actionable epidemiology. I can't get to frame the things that Ed is talking about unless I can actually show the consequences and what it means to do some analysis. Bringing that forward and having that feedback loop, which I think probably helped as a real way of doing it, and saying these are good, these are good directions you're going, maybe you're maximizing your bottom line, but here's where you're falling down on your other goals, and bringing that kind of a joint setting of what are we trying to achieve with all the elements together, and I think that that's a space the public health gets into. At the same time, we are then able to say what should be funded and how should be funded. And you know, as I tell my partner all the time, you know how we used to always say, oh, we're going to talk about that, and then I'll know what we do. Well, be careful what you pray for people right now. I have 738 people who work for me, and they're like, what do you mean? I'm going to do our business. You know, it's like, right, because they have figured out what we do. And they really want to get into the game. And we have to be ready to let them take that stage. But it is making those relationships, you know, getting other people to carry that water, whether it's the community organization, whether it's the Native American Coalition, or whatever it might be, whether it's the town or anything. Hey, wait a minute, these are the things, how we want our community to thrive and having them carry it forward to you. But it is linear. It is not linear. And but identifying who's making the decision and figuring out how they need to be influenced and how we can help them succeed. I would have come to my grave a year ago if I thought about me. I want the legacy health business to succeed. What can I do for George Brown? You know? And that entree, you know, has them redefine these things for our goals, for I have to say, it's like artwork to all the things that are different tables and it's not in here, and you don't necessarily have all the water.
I think you guys have the right question, and that's part of the circulating public. You set up a series of questions that really are part of each one of these things. And under that, strengthening the passive communities, we ask the people, you can't try to ask the question of everything. Who's at the table? Who's at the table? Who has the power at the table? We're certainly looking at that in our health department, all of our advisory committees. And I'm asking that for all the hospitals when they're talking about their community benefits dollars. Who's at the table? Who has the power? Really, who has the power at the table? Who's at the table? I think we have to model our own, you know, in terms of how we set up our own advisory committees and task forces, and we have to have that conversation with people in the context. So I'm using the school as well to do that. Also, when we are talking, we're using the ACA Extend Grants Reservation model to develop on communities for health. We're coming to the point with that I don't want healthcare to be in charge of health. And I don't want public health to be in charge of health. I want the community to be in charge of health. And so we're trying to develop ACOs, public care organizations, and then embed them in the communities and develop a community governance model so that they can actually use the resources to invest in the most appropriate way. We've got some models going on, we're still learning, but it's a question that has to ask who's at the table and who has the power.
Let's talk a little bit about capacity building. It came up in each of the three presentations today about how do all of us grow the capacity at multiple levels to do this work differently for population health. So I'm going to put something up to show you, and I'd like to see a show of hands if you've ever heard or seen this before. Hands up.
The world that we're envisioning is not the world we're in right now, and it's a world
part of people in all the health professions, especially in public health, but all the health professions do this. We're educating people for a world that no longer exists or is rapidly growing out of existence. In the public health realm, it has become, we have adopted a rubric which is called Framing the Future, the Next 100 Years of Public Health Education. Now you're thinking, well, that's humorous if I've ever heard it, right? But the fact is that just like medicine 100 years ago was the Welsh Rhodes Report, which established the model of public health that we have today, following on the medical report, which came 5 years earlier. So we think it's about time for us to kind of read that model. And if you go to the AFCCH.org website and go under the education index line, you will find all the documents that we've created over the last 24 months, or even a little more than that, that focus on what should we be teaching about public health in community colleges, at the undergraduate four-year level, at the MPH level, at the DRPH level, and what should public health be taught in all professions. So it's a much, much broader view on kind of what public health education is now, and I agree very much with that. Health care and public health is far too important to be left to health professionals. Okay? It really has to involve all kinds of folks. So there's a lot of this going on, this ferment is going on in medicine, it's going on in nursing, dentistry, pharmacy, it's going on in veterinary medicine as well, and certainly it's going on.
Okay, so now future. I'd like to speak to the people who have a comment or question on the paper rank folks that are here or something that is worth saying. Thank you. I got one, I got two again, and I got three. Let's start with number three. Stand up, come on up, introduce yourself, and let us know what's on your mind.
My name is Kate Douglas. I'm in Chicago, Ontario. And I've been doing this kind of work for most of my life. So it's two questions. So one is, I totally agree about capacity building, and I'm interested to know some specifics. And I also want to say that as health professionals, we need to be humble. Now, we don't really understand a lot of the issues, and that we really are should be learning our capacity to increase and can find community. And so perhaps, you know, that it's not like, well, I have that you need, but actually, you know, we have some skills, and communities have many assets and skills to teach us. So how do you envision that two-way process, not a one-way process?
Want to take it?
Thank you. You have to take that. That's a great question. You have to change the way you practice. You have to change your practice. So this is one example. So we knew in our state, we have lots of health disparities. States. And so we really wanted to find somebody who does it. So we decided we were going to put together a report on how to advance health equity in the state. But instead of us writing the track, we actually went out and did interviews throughout the state. And thousands of meetings from that information that came together and wrote the advanced health equity report. Then they brought it back to the community and said, do you hear your voice in this report? If they didn't hear their voice in the report, we rewrote it. So we went back and forth for a long time to get the advice of that, so that the community embraced it, or to change the whole flavor of what we wrote, of what was written, and to change our relationship with the community, so we're now more in partnership than we have ever been before. So it's changing our practice and how we do things.
Okay.
Thank you very much. I'm Robert Rose, I'm the director of public health for Chiapas, Mexico. And if you would indulge me, I actually have three questions. Veronica, I'm curious, the model that you seem to have to cause your health system to tie into population health outcomes is basically personal virtue. How do you get beyond that? That's one question. Do you want me to do all of them? One second.
Mine should be two, unless we do that third.
Yeah, so another question I have would be transformational change management. It's a skill set which doesn't normally exist in most sectors, in most careers, including population health. We have a But I have seen that there really is a sense that, I mean, it's the hardest thing in the world is to transform a religion, to transform an organization. And that's a special skill set, and that's why I'm asking to exist with this business. And I'm wondering what you all think about that and how that is something that we can do, because without that, we'll make a lot of effort for profit and bad.
Just with one system, healthcare, medicine, clinical care, health experts in charge of public health, just like I would say you wouldn't want public health experts in charge of your colonoscopy, right? But you do have people working collaboratively towards that end. And we'll come back to that. In terms of the change in autism, I have a couple of members from my team here, and they will tell you without a doubt that the hardest part of the job is change management. Everything in healthcare education continues to train people to understand 80% of some of the basal conditions, not on the family unit, social context or cultural context, has far wider impact on that child and family. And so the change management, even though you're developing the model of partnership, designing new ways to pay for an outcome that is, we don't care if healthcare delivers the primary room, public health does, juvenile justice does, child welfare does, we want the outcome. And yet, we know financially, those payment systems are fairly rigid. So we have to test new models to understand how can we sustain towards the outcome of health equity. And in case management programs, so how do you do this?
Okay, I have to jump in because
I think this is absolutely the crux of one of the issues. This country has never had a health system before. We've been up here, the public health, we've never had a health system before. And the way that things have organized up to this point, there are a set of barriers that we really haven't addressed here, but we've teased them a little bit. But we talked about leadership, governance, and management. If we go back to the governance issue, one of the things I'm concerned about is what is the future organization for public health to be a good partner in what's going on in healthcare. If you look at Minnesota's statutes annotated, there are 1,500 laws that mention the phrase public health. So there's a regulatory role, and I'm not saying I'm against regulation, that's not my point. My point is that there is a regulatory role that adheres to what we do in governmental public health that is different from the role that is true of, say, community organizations focused on health and community. So I see that as a potential obstacle, not potential, it's a real obstacle. Full disclosure, I sit on the board of the healthcare delivery organization because they want to do public health population. So I'm very interested in how that regulatory role plays in this and prevents or enhances the ability of public health to be a good partner in making decisions.
Well, I'm so glad you read that, Mr. That is a great question. So our following team, we have got another 9 minutes. We're going to hear a little bit about roles, or regulatory roles, and then come back with the final closing question, because we've heard from our group.
So just 2 minutes. You're right. I think like money, we have to break our role as a regulator, and I think we have to think about the way we did regulate. But now we get to that. If I have a system, I regulate health licenses in the room. I have to not just implement those laws. I say, what are we all trying to do here? Trying to do something better, trying to provide access, trying to reach a rural under community that doesn't fit in to our. So how do we bring everybody around the table and say, this is what we want for our government to do. You guys figure out what we need to do. Like, we need making the changes at the CMS. But again, it's that how we educate. We need not just change management, we need health analytics people for us to do differently. We need health economists for us to do differently. And when I'm not going to do that, but I'll say that, I think we need to embrace the power of public health. You know, it's the reason why we're talking about drinking water anymore, because we have to do drinking water systems, you know. But in my state, right now, we're dealing with two old-fashioned diseases of E. coli and plague. You know, it's up to foot, but we won't have a lot of those because those systems are in place and they're regulated. How do we bring that together? But I think what we're talking about, not only financially, we have to figure out how to use our regulatory authority more creatively and get together with other agencies, including transportation agencies.
So we're talking about that from a regulatory perspective. Right. Okay, so my question, can I get to your question and respond to all John's way of saying?
Yeah, that's a real
question. Okay, so my question in closing is I'm one of the things that we heard is focus on outcomes, focus on results, focus on numerator and denominator, focus on accountability, so that we can and look at the data that can drive decision making and be able to see what the results are that we're getting. And public health is a really important player in that. So here's where I'm going to ask you for some quick data for those who are sitting. Think about this in the life scale, 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, right? 0, 5. I mean, I have a good talk about that. Does everybody have a 6? That's good. Okay, good. That's good. That's fabulous. Okay, we can use it for all kinds of scalar musical metrics. I'd like you to have a, if you have a little to stand one more time, you can sit for a long time. Will you do that? All right, good job. If you're so able and so moved, as you will be, I'm going to ask you to find something you haven't spoken of yet. And the question that you're going to try to come up with is, given the changes that are happening and the changes that we are making, how optimistic are you? How optimistic are you that this movement towards population health that reunites public health and healthcare can lead to healthier communities and health equity? How optimistic are you that this movement that we're going on will lead to both healthier communities and health equity? 0 meaning this, 1, 2, 3, 5 meaning fully optimistic. Find someone to compare your numbers and give you 1 minute to do that.
Things are in policy. understanding income inequality, health disparities, access, and health, environmental justice. And people are recognizing that that's intolerable, and they're starting to get organized, and they're starting to claim the power. And I think organizing principles 50 years ago this year, we started the war on poverty, which was a health and all policies approach that actually turned the curve of policy and set a threat to the power brokers, and they changed the policies. So I think that we're at 50 years from that, this is a good time. It's 100 years from the Mount Rose Report, which also said we need to look at the social condition. It's 150 years from when they really stopped the cholera epidemic in Great Britain because they had a health and all policies approach. I think now is the time that the communities are ready to move on changing that health and all policies approach to health equity as a whole.
And what piece of advice
do you have? Focus on the conditions. Don't focus on programs. Focus on the conditions in which people can be healthy. We have to public health as well. It's focusing on the conditions. It's not about services. It's not about programs. It's about the conditions.
Thank you.
Focus on the conditions. We have the power in agencies, not the population of the government, but the citizens, not the government. And I would like to say something else. I am afraid because we didn't lose the war of poverty. We gave up. And I think that we really have to think through where the money is. And that's bottom line. That's why it's a three. I'm a glass half full kind of girl. So normally I would say five, but I would say three. We don't really follow money.
I'm going to put money and I'm going to put five. And that's because I'm taught by Bill Fahey. And you know who Bill Fahey is. Hands up. One of my mentors, one of the great thought leaders in public health, who said the number one characteristic that defines us in public health is unwarranted optimism. And I have to add a generation and the younger to say persistent, unwarranted optimism. With that, I thank you so much for participating and I hope you'll see you again.